The Loose Cannons Podcast is a free-form discussion about film that contains mature language,
such as poop and titty,
and descriptions of mature situations,
such as filing taxes and raising children.
We do not have any concern for spoilers, so if you haven't seen the film or films we are discussing and don't want to have the twists ruined for you, please watch the film before listening to the podcast.
Real bonanzas are few and far between that take a lot of finding. Say, answer me this, will you? Why is gold worth some 20 bucks an ounce?
I don't know, because it's scarce.
1,000 men say go searching for gold. After 6 months, one of them's lucky. 1 out of 1,000. This find represents not only his own labor, but that of 999 others to boot. That's 6,000 months or 500 years, scrabbling over mountains, going hungry and thirsty. Now, it's a gold, mister, is worth what it is because of the human labor that went into the finding and the getting of it.
Never thought of it just like that.
Well, there's no other explanation, mister. Gold and stuff ain't good for nothing except for making jewelry with gold teeth.
Hey everyone, it's another Loose Cannons podcast coming at ya. Going old school again today. Very old school. The original threesome, if you've been listening to us from the beginning. It's me, Patrick, yeah. And Basil. No, yeah. Yeah.
It was a job interview. What a sucker.
Mm-hmm. I hate jobs.
Yeah.
As we may learn about from our discussions in this film today, mm-hmm. which is 1948's The Treasure of Sierra Madre, directed by John Huston, continuing in our AFI casts. But before we do that, let's do this. It's a little segment let's we like it. To call Heralds and Denouncements. Boop, boo-da-doo!
Beep, 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 beep. All right, well, I'm going to denounce a movie called Early Man.
Early Man.
Or Early Man, I guess, is the way that it should be said. I don't know. Another directorial effort from Nick Park of the Wallace and Gromit series and the Chicken Run fame.
Aardman Studios.
Yep, Aardman Studios. A lot of English voice actors here.
There's nothing more just British than cavemen.
Yeah, I mean, this movie doesn't... I don't really know what this movie's supposed to be about. It's very weird. It's just, like, a lot of really stupid jokes. And I get that it's a kid's film, and, like, the humor is not supposed to be that sophisticated, but I think that it's too dumb even for children. All the jokes in this movie, and it's not even like slightly charming in the way that the Wallace and Gromit stuff is. Actually, like, why I think it's so well regarded is because, like, at the time it came out, it was fairly charming compared to other animation styles. But I don't think they get anything right in this movie. And I wrote in my review on Letterboxd that it feels like it was one of those movies written by the two hack screenwriters from That Mitchell and Webb Look. The guys who are just, like, lazy and don't put any work into writing their screenplays. I was like, it feels like it was written by those guys. It's the level of effort that it feels like they put into the jokes in this movie.
Yeah, it looked extremely bad from the trailer, so unless it was, like, a runaway hit, there was zero chance I was going to watch it, because I don't even like Wallace and Gromit. It's like, this looks worse.
Yeah. Yep. I assume it's a children's movie, but yet I've never seen a Wallace and Gromit or a Aardman Studios film when I've gone to the theater and there've been children there.
Right.
It's always adults seeing those dumb movies.
Yep. Shaun the Sheep weird. Movie. I guess children like that that series over there, but no crossover appeal.
I guess that sheep is very mischievous. I don't know.
Basil?
Paddington also not popular in the United States compared to popularity in the UK. There's a lot of things that I could herald. And very few that I could denounce. I've seen a lot of good stuff lately. But I'll just go ahead and Harold Stan Brackage, that guy rules. I rewatched a bunch of his short movies, and they're all still super good.
Some on drugs, some rewatching them after you were done doing drugs.
Yep. And all right. I think Black Ice and RageNet have pretty dark titles, but I was always just transfixed by the excuse me, my throat's doing something weird. Transfixed by the kind of like how pretty the hand-painted look looks, but then watching them this time, I was like, oh no, these are kind of dark and upsetting looking. And I get why they have those titles. And still pretty cool. So yeah, way to go, SB.
Now that you've seen Black Ice, are you going to watch its sequel, Black Rain?
Mm-hmm. Ridley Scott, also a fave. They're neck and neck. Favorite filmmakers.
I have a movie that I could herald, but I'm going to go off book a little bit to talk about a movie that I'm going to both herald and announce, just because it's a movie that I want to talk about. I liked it overall, and that movie is Double Indemnity, directed by Billy Wilder. And there's a speech that Walter Neff, Fred McMurray's Walter Neff, gives. It's either the second or third time that he meets Barbara Stanwyck's character, where they're at his apartment, and he's explaining to her why people don't get away with murder. It's because they get money involved. He's like, you'd think it was the cops. It wasn't the cops. It was the insurance agents that got them. That, you know, they tried to get money out of it, and the system won't let you get. I mean, he doesn't say this explicitly, but the system won't let you get money that isn't yours. That's the important thing. You can kill as many people as you want, and that's even sort of, if not outright stated, implicitly implied by the fact that maybe Barbara Stanwyck has murdered someone in the past, and didn't get money from that situation, and just slid on through. And if I like the movie as much as I like that speech, it'd be one of my favorite movies of all time. Thing I want to denounce is Barbara Stanwyck's hair, which is still really distracting for me. Like, I thought I'd grown up. I originally saw Double Indemnity when I was like 17 or 18, and I really found her hair upsetting at the time, and I was like, I bet it won't bother me this time. It still really does. It's not the only thing that I dislike about the film, but it's the thing I dislike the most.
What do you dislike about it? I can't even remember her hair, so I guess it has never stood out to me one way or the other.
Doesn't it look really stiff, I think?
The hair describing podcast, like, so yeah. She has like not bangs, but like this weird like curl at the front of her head.
Oh yeah.
And then like a very like flat on the sides.
Yeah.
And it looks like a wig that you would put on a mannequin, and Patrick's right, it never moves in the whole movie.
It's like one of those Lego pieces you put on the top of the Lego person's head. They put it on top of her head.
So it's like extremely stylized, but like I don't know why I am looking at super stylized hair for like most of the movie.
Right. Back in the day, before we had aerosol restrictions.
And
Donald Trump was right. Hairspray used to work really good.
And I'll herald and denounce myself, because when I first watched it, the reason why I didn't like Double Indemnity was because I didn't buy the romance between Neff and do you remember her name? Barbara Stanwyck. No.
I don't. He just calls her baby all the time, which is very funny.
Neff and baby. So I'm heralding the fact that I picked up that their romance was bad, but denouncing the fact that I missed the fact that Wilder wants us to think that it's bad. that it's just another transaction in a world of transactions. So, like,
it's true.
Other people who were like the movie because they thought it was like very tragic and sad that they couldn't be together. Like, at least I was better off than them, but I was still missing some of the points.
Anyway. Yeah. How completely wooden and like not into it both of them seem is like very, very funny to me now. And like, just the way that he says, "I love you too, baby," like in the most monotone way possible.
Yeah, and like how he's not like real, like he's interested in her. He's like, "This is a sexy woman," or whatever, the first time he meets her. But he like the first time he's like, "I love you, baby," is after they come up with the plan to get money. That's what he really loves about her.
He loves money more. Yeah.
He loves gaming his own system.
Yeah.
But still never will work.
And I think it was you who pointed it out that, like, every time that they meet after they've done the plan is, like, in convenience stores and grocery stores, and it's just, like, another consumer item being discussed, essentially. So, smart movie. Murder. Wish I liked it more. Mild Herald overall.
Boom. I'll take it.
Okay, speaking of capitalism, this was Patrick's pick. Tell us what happens in Treasure of Sierra Madre.
Alright, I will give you the plot rundown here. So we start with Dobbs and Curtin, who are two guys who are down on their luck in Tampico, Mexico, trying to do various jobs, getting ripped off at certain points, but they come into some money after they beat up a guy who shortchanged them on some work they did, and they run into Walter Houston's character, who is an old prospector, and is talking about how you could make a lot of money panning for gold in the mountains. So they decide to invest the money that they just got and head out to the mountains with Walter Houston to get some gold, and along the way they run into the pitfalls and perils of the wilds of Mexico. Bandits and mine collapses and other people trying to take a piece of what they're getting out of the gold mine. And a lot of wild stuff happens, and eventually the the gold gets blown back into the mountains where they originally pulled it from. And they're left basically back at square one with only a good story to tell, as I think Walter Houston's character says at the end.
Nope. But what a story. I'm pretty in the middle on this movie. There's things about it that I like quite a bit. And there's certain elements of it that are like kind of melodramatic in a campy way that feels like a little intentional, and I was like, oh, that's kind of fun. It's like giving like a kind of over the top feel to it, but then there are other parts that seem like pretty straightforwardly sincere and really dumb. So that really hampered my enjoyment of the movie. And I feel like especially in the second half, it just kind of piles on too many things that I was like, I don't like this at all. So it kind of undermined the goodwill that I had established in the first hour.
I can't believe that I watched a 2-hour and 6-minute movie with a character named Curtin, and no one once said, "It's curtains for you." It's the most mad I've ever been.
Bob's had plenty of opportunities.
I'm basically on the same page as Basil, but I'm willing to go as far as to say I didn't like the movie. I was mostly into it for the first hour or so, and then especially the last like 30 minutes, like I was like, I don't have any emotional investment in these characters, and I think I'm supposed to. Like, am I rooting for Dobbs to get away with it, or for him to get murdered? well, how do I feel about these bandits? Like, what? And so, like, I was just like, at a certain point, I was like, oh, I don't care about any of this now. Mm-hmm. Once the, like, I don't know, the capitalism discussion has passed, and it's just people try to escape dangers.
Right.
So, yeah, it lost me by the end. Also, the racism, which was...
Sure.
Went into it knowing about it, but still unpleasant to watch.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had those issues with it, too. Some racism, some exotification. Kind of right from the word go, too. Like... You immediately get the music stings at the beginning. I was like, oh dear, here we go, we're getting some really exotified music. But no, I actually ended up really liking this movie. And I think for kind of the inverse of the way that you felt about the end of the movie, Ruben, I felt like everything keeps piling up so much to an absurd degree that the movie actually became kind of absurd at the end. And the fact that you end with the two main characters just like hysterically laughing.
I do like
because
the laughing.
They've just been yeah, like hysterically laughing because they have just lost a fortune in gold to the wind is I don't know. I was like, I think it's all intentional, like how cuckoo bananas things go, where like Dobbs is just like psychotic by the end because he's so, his nerves are so frayed with the greed of capitalism, and then, you know, of course the like dehydration and sleep deprivation that he puts himself through, and then the whole thing with the bandits too. I thought the movie was actually a little bit sympathetic toward the bandits, being cornered as they were by the townspeople, and I guess there is, you can look at it and see like maybe we're supposed to root for them to get caught, but I don't know, something about the way that the charisma of the leader of the bandits came off made me feel like the movie actually had some sympathy for him, and for all of them, really. Because, I mean, like, at one point you see them just, like, fighting over shoes, and you're like, wow, like, they're so destitute. They yeah. have to, like, fight over someone's shoes. But yeah, I ended up enjoying it because I thought that it ramped up that absurdity at the end to a degree that I don't feel like I see a lot done in, you know, classic films like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So like about that point, one of the things that I liked about this movie is that every time that Dobbs and Curtin like have like a good thing going, it never lets us forget that their success doesn't help the like thousands of other people who are also suffering around them. Like, it's never right. like a true success, and that's one of the things that I like about the movie, and that I thought the movie was maybe going to be a little more forward thinking in issues of race than it was, because at the beginning there's this part where Dobbs is begging and gets money, and then a small Mexican boy comes up to him and tries to sell him technically a service, a lottery, and he's extremely awful to him.
Right.
And it's like, white people begging is okay, but small Mexican boy.
Yeah, get out of here.
Yeah, we hate him. And he even sort of like makes a comment about that later. Like, you know, he's like, white people have it really hard here. And what's it called? Tampico, I think.
Mm-hmm.
to Curtin, like, I don't know if that's the first time that they've met or, but mm-hmm. it's the first time that they meet on screen, and he's like, you know, they'll let you beg, but they'll run you out of town for shining shoes. And I'm like, well, they're just defending their business interests.
Yeah.
That's the skill that they have and that they get paid for. They don't want,
right.
Yeah. And so I thought maybe the movie was going to be like a little bit from his perspective and like recognize that he was racist and that the movie would not be, but then the exaggerated accents and, as you sort of mentioned, like the exotification of the native characters being like, ooh, these people have a great life, they laze around, fish a little, you know, do peyote or whatever.
Yeah.
Howard getting fanned and fed grapes is like the most decadent. Very silly.
Yeah. That scene was pretty ridiculous. Like, they just keep feeding him, like, everything. Like, he's just like, oh, this, oh, that, oh, whoa. I was laughing a lot at what he was doing with his face throughout the movie.
But, yeah, also, I think that, like, I was also sort of thinking that it would be a little more forward-thinking. And I still think it sort of is in some regards. Like, I think it's pretty cool that none of the Spanish is ever, like, subtitled. And that, like, when two Spanish-speaking people are speaking to each other, they are speaking in Spanish. I feel like the trend would have much more often been have them speak in heavily accented English, even though that doesn't make any sense that they're just talking to each other.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wondered if that was our copy, so I didn't want to read too much into that, but...
No, I watched it on Amazon. Okay. It's the same deal. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Haley and I rented it on Amazon, so that is also the original.
As far as I can tell, no brown face characters in this,
yeah? Yeah. That's a very small bar to clear, but...
Yeah.
But some movies don't do it.
Nope. Including a movie I like a lot.
Yeah, and a movie we did on this podcast, The Magnificent Seven.
Yeah.
Sorry, you guys are like kind of breaking up for me a little bit, so it's hard to tell when you're talking and when you've stopped. So I'm kind of like pausing a lot and being like, okay, are they finished? Are they saying something?
We weren't.
Yeah. No,
no, it's fine.
But yeah, I was going to talk about the way that it I remember what I was going to talk about now. I think it's funny at the beginning of the movie that the guy that Dobbs keeps bumming money from is actually John Huston. Like when you finally get to see him, I was like, oh, that's John Huston right there, the director of the film. He's like, don't come asking me for anything else ever again. And I'm like, hey, you're in his movie.
It's true. Yeah, I to go back to the thing with the kid or whatever, it's interesting that, like, yeah, there's this sort of maybe, like, weird and not accurate, like, sort of, what's the word? Like, dichotomy or something within Bogart's character's mind, Dobbs's mind, like, that... Like, he, when he's begging, he's asking, like, an honest thing. He's like, hey, I don't have any money. Can you give me some? And that somehow selling a lottery ticket is, like, you know, a scam of some sort or whatever, even though, like, it should be the same thing. But, and then he ends up winning. And he's real excited about it then. Yeah. He's like, ah, you kid, get out of here. Oh, wait, I won? You're the best kid ever. Love this kid.
Yeah.
What a great day I'm having. Less,
an it, early hint the, towards the lottery his ticket
is less of a scam than the guy offering work.
Yeah.
Too.
Yeah, it's true.
I thought it was kind of funny.
100% a scam.
Yeah.
Yep.
More than a scam, it's slave labor.
Yeah.
Essentially, yeah. I also thought it was interesting that it looks like they're building an oil derrick, too.
Yeah.
In that scene,
making
too.
Making a lot of money. For free.
I was like, wow.
I like how the way that his scam works is that when anyone asks questions, he gets them drunk and leaves them.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I guess it makes sense for the plot or whatever, but I did think the scene was very funny at first when it looked like he was just going to kick both their asses. I was like, oh, this movie's getting extra pathetic. They're like trying to jump this guy and get their money back, and they can't even do that, right?
Yeah,
but then they eventually do, although they all look pretty awful, pretty off by the end.
Yeah, they are pretty out of shape though, because they're getting lapped by Walter Huston going up that hill.
That's true.
Didn't expect him to be part camel. One of the best lines in the movie.
Part goat, part camel. He's a seder camel man.
I think he won the Oscar for this. Walter Huston.
He sure did.
It's a pretty funny performance. Like, it, I mean, it's not exactly like a, I don't know. I mean, he kind of does the same thing the whole movie, but there is a funny, like, weirdness to the fact that he can, like, say really eloquent, like, kind of awkward sentences super fast. I always found that pretty enjoyable. I was like, well, he's just like, there's all kinds of, like, colloquialisms and, like, strange turns of phrase all, like, wrapped up in this, like, really, really rapid speech.
Yep. He's knowledgeable and spry.
Mm-hmm. But as far as the second half goes, like, I thought it was interesting that it seemed like it wanted to be, like, super dark, but then, like, Curtin kind of survives for basically no reason. Like, I was like, oh, this is pretty dark that, like, this guy who's, like, just, like, a regular stand-up guy, Humphrey Bogart's just murdering him and then moving on. And I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. But then it's, like, the very next scene, Curtin's just alive again and mostly fine, which is...
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
He's just got, like, a little bit of a shoulder wound, and he's like, oh, yeah, I'm riding with you.
Very good job of killing him.
Mm-hmm. And I do not like Humphrey Bogart's performance very much. I thought he was fine in the beginning, but, like, as he's descending into madness and talking to himself, I thought it was, I mean, again, like,
it's poorly maybe written. That's part of the problem. Yeah. Is that, like, no one does that, and so, like, what are you tapping into as an actor to, like, represent that?
That's true.
Yeah. Just
mumbling to themselves constantly.
Yeah, I think this is probably why they had Curtin survive, because it would have been really bad if at the end of the movie you're just watching Walter Houston just, like, talking to himself the whole time. And they're like, we need these two characters to still play off each other, so we're going to have him survive.
It was not Curtin's for Curtin's.
Nope. But one of the other parts that really started to sink the movie for me was after Cody dies and then they're like reading the letter from his wife or whatever. Yeah. I was like, oof, this is brutal. Like, I mean, it was very funny to me because at the very beginning of the movie I made the joke to Haley during the credits that the real treasure was the friends we made along the way. And then that's literally something in that letter. Yeah. Like, she's like,
yep,
but I know what the real treasure is. My love for you or whatever.
Yeah. There was a section of the movie where each note that I took was, oh no, blank. So it went, oh no, the accents. Oh no, the letter. Oh no, squad jokes. Oh no, big musical sting for something the audience already knows. And that was when we saw Curtin crawl away, but then when Dobbs goes back and sees that he's gone, there's like a dun dun, and I'm like, who is this for?
Yeah, there were some weird music stings in this that I didn't understand. Like when they start pouring out the water to pan it the first time, there's like extremely dramatic music playing, and it's just like there's just water, like there's nothing really that exciting happening. They're just like panning some water. It's like da 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 da.
Sometimes out here, water's worth more than gold.
Yeah, I think the other thing that, I mean, there's like a lot of weird foreshadowing that's sometimes fun and sometimes very on the nose. Like immediately when they meet Howard or whatever, and he's talking about gold and prospecting and how, you know, you never met a prospector who died rich or whatever, then they always get going. Like Humphrey Bogart very point blank's like, that's not what I would do. then, it's like, oh, okay, that's exactly what he's going
to
do.
Yeah. And he like turns to Curtin. He's like, do you think that someone would do that? Like, why would they be different with money than they would be without money? I wonder what the theme of this movie is.
I did think it was funny, like, how little I had to think about some of this stuff, too, because it does spoon feed you a lot of different stuff in the story. Like, I mean, you can almost like trace the trajectory of where each character is going to end up by like their characterization in the beginning, where you're like, oh, you know, you get a scene where Curtin like saves Dobbs from the mine cave in, but then you see Dobbs just like constantly being distrustful of everybody, and you're like, I bet he's not gonna make it. I bet he's gonna betray them at some point.
Yeah, I actually liked, I bet he's gonna be like the Matt
Damon in Interstellar.
Yeah, the mine scene I liked kind of a lot, because I was like it seemed like Curtin actually had a moment where he's like, maybe I won't save him, and because then like later when Dobbs is like, I owe you my life, brother, he's just like, forget it, and like the way he like throws it away, I was like, oh, he doesn't actually feel proud of himself, because he's also thinking about the part where he's like, I don't have to save him, and then
he thought about it.
Yep.
I don't necessarily like it in the context of the movie itself, but as a representation of the bad circular arguing that people will do in order to justify whatever point they feel, I like when Curtin gets the best of Dobbs, and he's like, all right, so you go ahead. And he's like, why? So you can get the jump on me from behind? And he's like, when you catch up to me? And he's like, okay, all right, then I'll go ahead. And he's like, so you can wait on me and then jump out of somewhere and get me? I was like, okay, so we'll go together and I'll watch you until you go to sleep. And he's like, I'll go to sleep after you. It's like, what is going on with this guy?
It's true. Not a very good plan on Curtin's part.
Yeah.
I feel like at that point he'd be extremely justified in killing him.
Yeah.
Because he's like basically been like, said, okay, no matter what you do, I'm going to find a way to get that gun, and then I'm going to kill you with it. And be like, well, okay. Like,
well, he should have tied him up. I mean, if he didn't
want to. Yeah, I mean, he suggests that at some point, and I was like, why didn't he do that? I mean, I guess it would be risky to do it, because you have to use, he'd still have to hold one hand on the gun, which pretty hard to do while tying a knot.
I also think it's interesting that they actually like vote to kill Cody before the bandits show up, and they're like walking up there to kill him, and then he's like, look, bandits, and then they're like, oh shit.
That's
and
one of the like, things that makes the letter so weird to me. It's like it's like 5 minutes after they were gonna kill him, and they're like, oh, now we're all sad, our friend is dead. It's like, what? Is that your friend?
It's a little bit, it's a little bit disingenuous, I'd say.
But that's all it takes, you know? Once men have fought on the same side against a common enemy, they're brothers for life.
Mm-hmm. There's no historical examples of going against that, for sure.
Nope, never.
Certainly not a giant world war that people fought in, where two sides immediately started fighting each other after the war was over.
I thought that was again a moment where the movie like seemed like it was trying to go in a dark direction, but then they're like, we gotta pull this back a little bit, so then they do, and then Cody's conveniently the one that dies in the fight with the bandits. I was like, this is all a little too neat. Makes it real easy for them to
hook. The thing is, like, it was so telegraphed too. I was like, oh, I bet he's gonna get shot, so they don't have to do it. And again, it was like, this movie was just like, don't think about it too hard, like, just take your medicine. Your medicine.
How come that whole tribe has never had a kid like almost drown and figure out how to deal with it? That was
to give him baffling to me.
I don't know
why he knew how to heal the kid better than they did. I do think it's interesting that what is basically
powers.
Yep, he is literally a white savior in that scene. They even have people like looking at him with like candles and shit, like he's Jesus. And I was like, oh boy, they're taking this white savior thing literally. Yeah, they're crossing themselves. I was like, wow.
But it's just like a contrivance so that they can have Howard go away since he's kind of the, you know, the stabilizing factor, because he's not gonna kill anyone, and you know, is also like that tilts the balance or whatever, because Curtin's not gonna do any double crossing either. But when it's just one on one, then there's nothing to stop Dobbs from being like, I want all this money.
Yeah, and they could sleep in shifts, or it'd be much easier for him to tie him up if there was a second prison and stuff like that.
For sure. So, but it's a very strange and elaborate contrivance to get Howard away.
Yeah. I mean, a more obvious one would have been for him to, like, have been bitten by a snake or one of those lizards that kills you, but they probably didn't want to kill anyone.
Yeah.
They heal a monster. Poor heal a monster.
But yeah, I mean, it would have even made more sense to do the opposite, although that would result in some kind of exotification probably as well. But just the idea of, like, him getting bitten by a snake and then, like, being taken to the natives, like, heal or whatever, and being like, I'll meet up with you guys once I'm better.
The better racism. She heard the train coming through her feet like a Native American woman in a movie. Yeah. They have special powers.
Yep.
Granted them by their race. So what makes this movie well regarded, I guess? Is it the performances? Is that why people think that it's canon worthy?
Is it?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. I was trying to think about that when I was watching it. I was like, because this is also fairly high in the AFI list, right?
Yeah.
Like, I can't remember. Mm-hmm. But
does John Huston's styling stand out to you from, like, other directors particularly?
No. I mean, that's the rub that the French auteurists have always said, that John Huston sucks. He's not a good director. I don't think I just agree with that. I think he's fine. But that, you know, he doesn't have the kind of auteurist personality you can point to of being like, oh, I can tell I'm watching a John Huston movie because of this. That other people like Ford and Howard Hawks and stuff tend to have in one way or another. But, yeah. I mean, rewatching The Maltese Falcon relatively recently, I think those might be the two only, like, John Huston movies I've seen, except for when as a teenager I watched Pritzi's Honor. But they both have, like, a similar, like, bordering on camp thing that I think is pretty fun and somewhat unusual for that. But yeah, especially, like, you know, considering this came, like, many years after Double Indemnity, which is a much, much darker movie, like, there's nothing about the darkness of this that should have seemed, like, that subversive or,
yeah,
surprising to audiences. And, yeah.
I mean, I think what people take away from it is, like, a general, like, greed is bad or whatever, and for some reason, when the message is that benign, it seems like movie audiences can really latch on to it. It's like the blander you make the message.
Well, I didn't really want to talk about audiences. I wanted to talk about AFI and critics and why it's on the canon. Like,
the blander you make that.
Audiences are extremely stupid, and I hate them.
Wow, this movie was really expensive. It cost $3 million.
Maybe that's why it's canonized.
Yep.
I mean it's probably canonized because, you know, like, Walter Huston's performance is remembered, obviously. It's like a, you know, they reference it in City Slickers 2 or whatever, and you know, Bogart's in it also, so I mean, pretty much anything that Humphrey Bogart's in is,
I bet, well, he was regarded. Nominated.
Yeah.
Yeah, Bogart. And, I'm sure he was.
Yeah, I think that, like, for the time it came out, too, like, not a lot of movies dealt in psychosis the way that this one does, and I was like, oh, there. It seems like at the time this came out, that was, like, a really, like, edgy topic to have in a movie. And So that it probably just like, you know, it's like Citizen Kane, like when you watch that it today, sense. you see that there are problems with it, but back when it came out, people were so blown away by everything that it was like Citizen developing Kane. And you're like, you what?
I mean, not exactly with Citizen Kane, since everybody hated it except for
filmmakers. Well, that's what I'm talking about. Like, when it came out, filmmakers were one, like the people who talked about movies were blown away by it because of its like styling and stuff like that, and that kind of got carried over as like this sort of like mythos that was handed down to the next generation of film critics, where it was like, oh well, this is the thing that you got to check out, you know, like, and if people say that to another group of people enough, like enough of them will carry that message through. And I think that's what goes hand in hand with a lot of the AFI movies, is that these are just sort of the movies that were like handed down to the next generation. And I mean, you do see some movement a little bit in the list from the initial list that they came out with, which is in like the late 90s.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
To the one that we're on, which is the 2007 list. So you can kind of see like where old stuff is being pulled off that, you know, nobody really regards anymore, or had like really obvious problems that just weren't addressed when they first canonized them, and then some newer stuff is being put on there, but like a lot of stuff has been handed down as like, I don't know, like kind of impeachable in a way, like The Godfather and Citizen Kane and Casablanca, and you know, I'm forgetting all the other ones in there. I know Psycho is really well regarded as
Singing
well.
In the Rain.
Yeah, Singing Where in the Rain. Where to Go. But yeah, I mean,
yeah, but
I don't know the level, like, especially since AFI is, you know, a school, and I don't know the level to which, when you're being, you know, I sort of like introduced to the idea of film canonization in a place where you are being taught by someone who is, you know, supposedly an expert on what they're telling you, how much you question that, especially like coming out of the school in the way people do, and the way that the film industry is all about like this collaboration. Like a lot of times the better collaborator you are, the more traction you have in the industry. And so if you jive really well with what they're telling you and believe what they say and collaborate well with them, you'll get ahead, and then you'll be the next generation of person who's perpetuating what's been handed down to you, you know, like maybe with a twist and an edge here and there, but like generally you're still, you know, running on the same, I don't know, the same wheel.
You play the game for so long you forget why you got into it in the first place.
It's interesting though, because
Go ahead.
I was just gonna say that I was just looking at the Wikipedia, and apparently Stanley Kubrick said this was his fourth favorite film of all time, which is I definitely remember that the end of The Killing has like an extremely direct reference to the movie in which money blows away in the wind. But also Sam Raimi said it was his favorite film of all time. Although I could kind of see that.
Sam Raimi
the
is
campy
a big fan
aspects of it.
Yeah, he is a big fan of Psychosis in his films. So.
Yeah. And then that
one of the better scenes of someone talking to themselves. Dr. Yeah. Octopus talking to his tentacles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, I couldn't do that. Innocent people. But you're right. The real crime would be not finishing my work.
But that also, this is should be less surprising to people who are. But Paul Thomas Anderson said that he watched it every night in bed while writing There Will Be Blood.
Makes a lot of sense.
So, like, one thing that I think the laughing maybe makes it a little bit better than my initial impression, but the first time that, like, we see the gold blowing away and it's, like, played kind of tragically when the bandits mm-hmm. don't recognize it. First of all, like, I think that scene is, like, a little bit insulting. It's like, these guys are too dumb to know what they have.
Yeah.
Dumb bandits. But the other thing is, like, if this movie is about how money is bad and corrupts you, shouldn't we all be celebrating the gold is blowing away? Like, isn't this the end of them all wanting to betray each other? Like, isn't that...
Like, I mean, I think the end is celebratory in a little
way. Yeah, I said, like, I said the laugh brings it back a little bit, but everything up until that point is very tragic, and it's not like, I don't know, it's not like that other moment doesn't exist or is erased by the fact that the laughing happens. Like, I feel like there's a bit of wanting to have it both ways.
Yeah, I thought that about him, Curtin, getting shot as well, because I was like, oh, this is, like, such a dark moment in the movie, and then it pulls it back, but I was like, but I still felt that weird emotion before it was revealed to be fake, and I was like, that's sneaky.
Yeah, I see what you're saying about trying to have it both ways, because the movie kind of both wants to be like, oh no, their money blew away, but it also wants to be like, no, greed is bad. And so it gives them these, like, saying, you know, sort of like, yeah, it's sort of the happy outs where it's like, oh, I'm, you know, Walter Houston's gonna go be a medicine man now, and Curtin's gonna you know, go off to Texas and, you know, find
have
this
sex with Cody's
now widow. Yeah, find Cody's widow who has a peach orchard or whatever.
Take her to,
like,
the
oh, they actually got what they wanted in the end.
So, he's gonna raise some peaches, if you know what I'm talking about.
I think there is an aspect to that, though, that, like,
maybe it's gonna be an eggplant and a peach farm, if you know what I'm saying.
There's feel like there's something pointed about the way that they go into detail about the way that the Federales kill the bandits too, because they have that scene earlier where it seems like it's kind of an offhanded thing that Cody is just, like, saying to Curtin to, like, you know, just kind of, like, start a conversation with him where he's talking about the firing squads and everything and how they make them dig their own graves. But then you see it again in the film at the end, and I don't know, something about that seems like, oh, it's like these, you know, white people who showed up and, you know, basically, like, took all the gold that was here in the land, like, they still have, like, happy lives to go back to, but, you know, these bandits who are out here struggling and, you know, being pursued are, like, they're dead now. They had to dig their own graves and get shot and fall into them, and I was just like, yeah, that there's a little bit of, like, I don't know, pointed sadness of, like, the people who actually live here, who you know, were here before these white people came into town, you know, are just, like, gunned down mercilessly, and nobody cares about them anymore, and they don't get a happy ending the way that these people who just, like, showed up and, like, had an adventure and then, you know, oops, they lost all their fortune, but they are still okay. They still got, you know,
except for Dobbs.
Good. Yeah.
He got stabbed.
And I mean, like, Dobbs is, again, it's a little bit of that, I mean, it's a little bit of that, like, Ghost in the Shell thing where it's like, he was a bad capitalist because he tried to hurt the other capitalists. he suffered his fate because he was a bad capitalist, not because he was, you know, the system doesn't suffer its fate. The system keeps going. It keeps, you know, grinding people down. And I do admit that the movie doesn't hit that point hard enough, but I do feel like it's just pointed enough in showing the way that, like, the fate of the bandits, I think, that
before that even made me sadder, which is that I'm not even sure if it was 100% intentional, but there's a, so you see them the first time, or I guess the second time, when they have the fight on the top of the mountain. And then you see them again when they run into Dobbs with the burros. and the difference in their costuming, and like, I don't, like, they used to have shoes, they no longer have shoes, like their clothes are all torn up, they look really wasted, and of course Dobbs looks really bad too, but Dobbs has been ruined by his own decision making, and they have been ruined by being chased by agents all around the world. And I was like, oh, this is sad. Like, I know that these guys are a threat, but I feel bad for what's happened to them at this point. And yeah, I mean, that it's something that worked for me about the film. I think
I think if the movie, like, because it's such a like spoon-feedy movie, I think if it really wanted to make you truly dislike the bandits, like, it would have gone full black hat with the bandits. And I mean, they aren't good guys by any stretch, but I do still feel like there is like some charisma and charm to the, at least the leader of the bandits, because he's always like smiling, and he's like coming, he's like walking up on Dobbs, he's like, hey, what's going on? And even the way that he's talking to the people in the village, like where he's trying to sell the mules, he's like being really friendly and like kind of charming, and you know, he's kind of a scalawag more than a, you know, just like mustache twirling villain.
I don't have any disagreement with you. I don't know if you're saying this, like, I said something about that at the beginning of the podcast. I said that part of the reason why I don't like the ending is I don't know, feel like the filmmakers know exactly what they want me to feel. So I don't feel like, I'm not saying they want me to feel like hatred towards them, but I also don't think they exactly want me to feel good towards them. They haven't landed. It's the same thing with the gold. Like, oh, do they want me to feel bad that the gold blew away, or do they want me to feel like it's funny that the gold blew away? Like, there's a lot of just like, we're going to hit every point.
Mm-hmm. Do it all.
There's
a mistake when you're making Subway sandwiches. Put all the toppings on there.
Give me everything. There definitely is an ambivalence that's not, doesn't feel intentional.
Yeah, I mean, I felt the same way early in the movie when they have the like train fight or whatever, and they're like shooting them, and then like I was like, oh, you know, that's like a pretty standard action scene. But then afterwards, like, Dobbs kept talking about how excited he was that he had killed them. He's like, I got three of them. You guys didn't get as many as me. And I was like, whoa.
And he makes like a smiley face when he's looking out the window too. He's like,
I'm really excited.
More foreshadowing of Dobbs's eventual betrayal.
Mm-hmm.
I did think it was interesting though. Probably like not great and nuanced, but that the most seemingly like communistic society portrayed in the film, which is the, you know, the village that Howard goes to save the boy, is like this paradise where everybody's just like laying around like eating fruit all day and swimming, and then the city where all of the capitalism is happening is like just this hellscape where there's just destitute people everywhere and everyone's scrounging for money and, you know, trying to beat each other down. And I was like, that's, you know, at least something in a movie from 1948, because I feel like they blacklisted stuff for way less than that.
Sure. It's the thing that I like about this movie. It's why I was liking this movie for the first half of it. Maybe even a little bit longer. I just feel like it loses its way. Not unlike Dobbs.
Yep. Yeah, it doesn't need to be as long as it is either.
Yeah.
Because, like, it seems pretty early on once they're doing the mining that, like, okay, like, Dobbs is way more into this than everyone else, and he's definitely going to turn on them. And then we get like multiple scenes in a row of him like being a jerk in one way or another. I'm like, all right, I know where this is going. Like, we don't need to see like every time. It's like punching a guy, almost punching a guy,
yelling because he's called a hog, killing a lizard.
Yelling because he thinks he's trying to steal his stuff.
What really bothers him is just being called a name.
But it's not.
Don't call me names.
It's not what really bothers him. That's a lie.
What really bothers him is that he wants more of the money.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. He does throw that money away.
Yeah, but then he steals all the money.
Yeah, and
he steals all the money.
Right.
Well, yeah,
and that
at the end. But I'm saying, like, in that scene in particular, like, what bothers him is being called a name.
I don't think so.
No, because he throws that money away, but that's only like $200, which compared to the like $50,000 that he wants each, like, that's nothing.
Yeah,
like,
if he could,
it's in my opinion, it's a performative act. It's not because he doesn't care about the money. It's because he's trying to shift the attention in that moment because he's played his hand out already.
Yeah, he's revealed that if it were up to him, because he put more money in, even though he acted like that was no big deal at the time, he should get a larger percentage of the total. So like, if they get like $100,000, the fact that he put in like 70% of the initial stake, he should get 70% of that $100,000.
Yeah. Like,
and
he keeps
they would
being
never
like,
agree
that's,
to that.
That's what someone could do, but I'm not going to do that. Just don't call me a hog. And it's like, well, it kind of sounds like you would do that.
Yeah, sounds like that's what you want to do.
I don't think it's a conscious thing on his part, though. Like, he would do that. We know that. But he still wants to believe himself as not being that person. Like, he's still in that moment, like, trying to... like be like,
sure.
Oh no, I'm not really that person. I'm not
but
really
one
you know,
of the reasons why
he like...
is upset at being called a hog is because it's true. Like, that's why
yeah.
it upsets him.
Yeah.
He wouldn't be as upset if it weren't true that he weren't super greedy.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he
wants all that money
that, for sure.
Yeah, and I mean, later in the movie, like, he comes up with like the thinnest justification ever for wanting to steal Howard's money. Is like, ah, that lazy sad sack, now we have to drag his burrows all over the place, we should just steal this money. That would show him like this like couple days of inconvenience like is, way outweighs like the 10 months that they spent together and all the expertise that he taught them.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like, okay, so this is the way that I see that character, because I think that you guys are just like, I don't know exactly, but it seems like he doesn't want to believe for the longest time that that's actually his plan. Like, he's going about it, he's even like not sure himself that that's his plan until he gets that moment where it's like, oh, it would be really easy to do that now. Like, I actually could do that. Like, he, until it's put in front of him that he could steal all the money, it's not his plan. Until, like, because I think if it had been his plan all along, he would have come up with a better way of, you know, like, getting them out of the way. Like, he could have, you know, had the mind collapse on them at some point or something like that. Like, he would have been more nefarious in actually undermining
them. I don't
them,
think either of us said
it was
his
like
plan all along. We said that it was his character all along, that is his who he is as a person, whether or not he had decided to steal the money. And when he's called out for being the greedy person that he is, he performatively throws the money into the fire to show that he's not that greedy, because it would be a very bad situation if he were to be like, yes, give me all the money at that point.
Because they would just be like, all right,
he's been greedy
dubs.
From the very beginning of the movie. Like, even when he's begging, and he's like, the first time you're like, yeah, he needed that food or whatever. But then he's like paying for a shave and for a beer, and he's not like saving that money for a future date. I'm like, I mean, I am all for poor people being able to have amenities. They should have a decent standard of living. But his character, I think, in the movie is shown to have that quality
yeah.
to him from the get-go.
Yeah, what they even when they talk about like what they're gonna do with all the money or whatever, like the other two people have very practical plans, and he's like, I'm gonna buy a dozen of every suit and
yeah.
be out on the town and
yeah,
sleep with prostitutes.
Super impractical.
Like, yeah, it's just like I'm gonna burn through all that money. And I have all the things.
I also like when Kurt asks him, he's like, yeah, what after that? And he's like, what would be after that? It's like he can't think of anything beyond just getting the, you know, the
riches. Oh, I think that that's supposed to be an innuendo, actually, because then Walter Houston's character brings up women, so I think when he says what after that, he means, like, prostitutes. That's what's after that.
Maybe. The movie's not super clear on that. But
I mean, because it has to be an innuendo.
I just took it as his character just, like, not thinking that far ahead. Like, he's just like, give me the money.
Why not both?
Yep.
Why not both?
Prostitutes and then... and then what? That's a good question.
Death.
But...
I gotta choose. I get both.
It's interesting that the way that Howard is written or whatever... the implication that, you know, he's kind of seen it all, and that, you know, he, like, they're like, hey, if you had all this money, how come you didn't, how come you're sitting here in this crappy hotel? And he's like, well, what did I just say about prospecting? I'm no better than any other man.
Yeah.
I had a fortune and blew it trying to find another.
I think one of the implications of who he is as a person at this point is kind of interesting, which is the reason why he's, like, kind of fair and ecumenical compared to, like, the other two, is simply that he's survived this long. Like, that, that he's like, it always turns out bad when you, when you're awful. I've seen it. I've always been the guy who gets shot and has to drag himself out of the desert. So
I've been Curtin one too many times.
So I'm just going to be nice and hope that being nice works out.
Doesn't, though.
It sort of works out. He ends up
Well, it works out for him, I guess.
Yeah.
It works out for him and Curtin, not so much for Dobbs.
But it is funny that, like,
sort of works out for Dobbs.
I wonder if that's like an intentional. Yeah. Yeah. Never has to beg for another peso. But I do think it's sort of interesting, like, and I wonder if this is kind of an intentional irony, but like the amount of money that Curtin has when he goes to Texas is like the same amount of money that they started with. Like, I think it was like $600 or whatever. So, like,
it's intentional. He says that. He says, I'm no worse off now than when we went up into that
mountain. Right. Okay. Yeah. But
I didn't really lose anything.
That's all it would have taken for him to get back to America and have a good life. And instead of doing that, they just had this stupid dream of being rich.
When they get the money that they're owed from that awful manager dude, they like, it shows them like drinking or something, and then they're like, the money's gonna run out soon. But then when they say to the prospector guy like how much money they have, they're like 150 each, and I'm like, that's how much money you just got from him. They've already decided the money's gonna run out soon. They've literally just gotten the money.
Yeah,
well, that's pretty smart of them.
They made that determination based on, like, and like two drinks later, yeah. They were like, you know, this isn't gonna last us forever. We should do something with this.
Also, I thought it was a moment of like false nobility when they beat up the guy, because he has way more money in his wallet, and they throw it back at him, but like they should have taken it and like went to look for other people and be like, hey, did you work for this guy? We just beat him up and took his money. Like, here's some of what you're owed.
Yes.
But they're like, we're not going to take more than we're owed. That's all we ever wanted. And then just give it back to the guy who stole from, like,
I don't know. That seems like a really impractical system, though. Like, how do you just go around asking people, like, hey, are you owed money by this guy? Like, anybody could just say yes.
They ran into that guy at the bar and who just overheard them talking. He seems pretty notorious.
I mean, they don't know where to find him anymore.
Okay. You're right. They should have just given it back to the guy. Like, even if they took it, that's still better than giving it back to the guy who is just, like, going to use it to exploit more labor later.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe he learned
There's
his
nothing
lesson.
Noble about
He's going to be a good capitalist from now on.
Bad capitalist. Bad.
Yeah, I agree with you. It seems like it's a scene that's included specifically to make us not feel as bad for them having beaten the crap out of someone, but it's not an actually truly noble act.
Right.
Because that guy doesn't deserve any money. He deserves to be in jail.
Yeah. Right.
Assuming the movie takes place, when does it take place?
The 20s, I think.
Yeah.
So
1925, I think is what it's
long,
like.
Long after slavery had been outlawed, especially in Mexico.
Right. And
yep.
That's all I have, really.
Yeah. He's part of the Gilded Age. He's got that roaring 20s money. Yeah, I'm done.
All right.
Way to go, AFI.
Thanks for listening, everybody. I hope you are enjoying the podcast. If so, you can subscribe using your podcast listening application. And you can now give us a 5-star rating and review on the phone app. You no longer have to go to your computer and sign into iTunes. So that's really helpful. You can find all of our content on our website, loosecannons.net, including new videos, writings, and all of our podcasts. And you can also go to our Patreon at patreon.com/loosecannons, and if you give us money, we will do things for you. If you give us enough money.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, thank you. Like we do with Michael Quinn, our sole donor right now.
All right. And if you want to go ahead and watch the next film that we will be doing, should be Eyes Wide Shut. So watch Eyes Wide Shut, and that should be next.
Yeah. More Kubrick on the podcast. It's been a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
Bringing him back.
One of our more popular podcasts, I think.
Yep.
I don't have exact numbers.
Well, hopefully the same is true of this one.
Thanks for listening.
Hopefully.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. I'm gonna go to the bathroom.